Hello, everyone. Before we begin the episode with Casey Sapp, the founder of Virtual, talking about underwater VR cameras, Peter, the co-host and producer of the podcast, and I have a short announcement to make, which is that after 5 years of podcasting about VR and research and everything in between, that this will be our final episode. When we started 5 years ago, we were all in college. We were... it was actually three of us, and we were deep into learning about virtual reality. We were all in cognitive sciences, and we've been really happy about the opportunities that this has brought us. The people we've met, the people we've talked to, the conferences we've attended, and some of you, the listeners that we've met. I think that's really been truly, truly inspiring. But yeah, I think after 5 years, it's, I think also at the pace that we have been in towards the end of this podcast, I think it's time that we kind of publish our final episode and, leave this archive up on the internet for people to download and listen to whenever they'd like. And I think, and I hope that this will also be a time capsule that describes the kind of the beginning years of virtual reality, what people were thinking, what people were doing, and, some of the people that, you know, create this kind of industry that will really grow in the future, like what they were doing in the early days. So that's truly my hope. That has been my hope. And I think, you know, keeping it as an archive that's available, I think, is a big goal of mine.
Mm-hmm. I think you summed it up really beautiful for us. I mean, 5 years is quite a long time, right? We had many episodes, many guests, and the ecosystem changed quite a bit in that time. You know, things got a little bit more advanced, mature in a sense of mass adoption, but it's also that in that time, the science that we started in the beginning, the team that we had in the beginning, right? And also like the topics that we had in the beginning really diverged from all the different areas and converged really much to this whole aspect of interviewing really successful tiny and bigger VR companies. And we have, you know, quite a lot of listeners, or we had quite a lot of listeners in a sense. And it was really a fun ride. And we had many multiple amazing guests, and you know, we had probably a really good run, right?
We did. We totally did. We also outlasted probably a lot more like VR projects with their podcasts or your YouTube channels, etc. No, it's cool, like especially being around in 2015 and 2016, like I think those were very special years. And it's nice to see already just in 5 years, there's actually quite a lot that's happened. Quite a lot of things assumptions that we had about the industry, that played out very differently. You know, like I think we were expecting AR glasses to be available by now. And it just showed how little we understood about like what it really took to create an AR headset. But at the same time, VR has truly grown and is now starting to break into the mainstream, and seeing how that's happening is pretty amazing. By the way, let's not forget the Quest was like the holy grail of VR when in 2016, you know, you wanted the Rift, like mobile, and like we would with inside out tracking. That was like extremely difficult to do. And the fact that now that's just super normal just goes to show how quickly things progressed in 5 years.
I mean, back in the days before we started the podcast, or just where we started, you know, we were thinking about those omnidirectional thread mirrors and, you know, how headsets will actually work in the end, right? How the tracking will work, how everything will come together. And now we are at a time where there's Quest 2, where it's quite, you know, a large amount of those things being sold out. And anecdotally, from what I heard from some developers, you know, there are even grandmas playing it.
It's true. It's true. People are playing like Puzzling Places.
Yeah.
A lot of people are playing it.
We seem to be, you know, a few years away, but only a few years away from this intelligent click thing, right? Where we have some kind of augmented reality glasses and some kind of BCI, some kind of, you know, interaction with our mind. It's creeping on us. And I think it's probably going to be way, way different than we anticipated. But from the technological perspective, we were, I guess, always on the right track with our guests. And what happened through those 5 years is also, especially you as a, you know, interviewer, you grew really strong. I mean, one of the reasons that you did, the last quarter of the episodes almost alone is because you just managed to get those very interesting guests, but also really tickle out the essence of what they were doing. And I think we should also acknowledge that, you know, the listeners and me. I mean, I just speak for the listeners, you know, because you're always worried, you know, is it good enough? Is it not good enough? And in the end, I mean, if you just look at all the episodes and all the topics we had, you basically followed the whole VR industry.
As much as I want to delete our first like 20 episodes, I'm not going to. We definitely shouldn't, because it's just so different. Capsule. You know, it's a time capsule for sure. And I still, of course, love how it started. The first episode starts with Krzysztof going like, "It has begun," and so it did. But yeah, no, it's, you know, the podcast took the twists and turns that were related to us and kind of like what our interests were. And, you know, at some point we kind of, as we also were being less involved in science and like research, and like actual research, you know, like the conversations more followed the topics that we were more working on or like interested in. And that's fine. That's good. You know, it doesn't have to be one thing. And I don't think any of you complained to either. Like, I think people were happy to listen to the things that we were wanting to provide. So I'm just happy that we were able to do this, that, you know, I grew up listening to podcasts, and to be able to host one has been like an honor. And the fact that it's about like a subject that I care very deeply about has also been another honor. And I have nothing but good feeling. I mean, of course it's bittersweet that this, you know, there's an ending to this, but that's okay. Like, we never made this into a business, honestly. Like, we've never monetized it. We only had a Patreon running, I think, between 2018 and 2019. We did launch another one, which like we never really, because like we weren't publishing episodes, we never really like let's say took care of. But the initial Patreon actually was nice. It helped us through some tough times.
Definitely.
And yeah, I think we have nothing but gratitude. And maybe. I'm sorry if people want to just jump to the podcast. We have the timestamp about the conversation in the description, so you can head on over to that point. But yeah, I think it's worth it for us to kind of just say hello and say goodbye to listeners that have been with us since the beginning.
You mentioned this time capsule thing. So not only did you grow up with listening to podcasts, but me too. I was very inspired by the German open source community and stuff. And that's why the podcast is theoretically / technically / practically speaking, actually under the Creative Commons license. So not only did we never made a real business out of it, it's technically also, if you look at the RSS feed and stuff, under the Creative Commons 3.0, whatever. So I think if you double check it, and if you want, you know, to repurpose it for some educational purposes and stuff, it's free. I think we never mentioned it in the podcast before, now that, you know.
I had no idea. One thing that people can do then legally is, and I want this to happen, is generate a text-to-speech using our voices. Like, hell yeah. Revive us, you know, like keep this going. Hopefully not with horrible things that we're saying, but that would be cool a couple of years down the line to have our younger voices speaking.
I mean, you could right now be speaking to some weird research AI from, you know, maybe, I don't know, the Washington Times or whatever in 20 years, right? Some journalist AI that is right now listening through this whole archive.
That's true.
To uncover how the VR industry evolved.
Yeah. And if someone's listening to this in 2030, like, I hope those Apple glasses are pretty sweet. You know, the second generation or third generation ones. Because we're still waiting on those. maybe then I'll give an intro into the Casey Sapp episode. Yeah, this episode is honestly really interesting. We recorded it back in late 2020. Now it's early 2021. Casey is one of the pioneers of stereoscopic 360 cameras that are being filmed underwater and for like high budget production films. You know, typically we, apart from the early days, we didn't cover 360 cameras all that much because like they sort of quickly felt that they were losing relevance also in the VR world. But Casey's work actually is also shown beyond VR headsets and on like large panoramic displays and like, you know, kind of like museum exhibits, which are beautiful. I think that's actually a great application of high res 360 videos, is like actually projecting it on a dome. It's quite interesting, like the things that he had to go through to build and iterate on a camera that works underwater. And yeah, I think it's definitely a great episode to finish this podcast with, because things that we've always been interested in are first and foremost technology, like just building technology, what, you know, what can be done now, what is just over the horizon, and like what you can do as either one person or like a short small development team, and also yeah, what use cases that, you know, opens up. What new ground are you breaking with technology? And of course, there's an entire world that we don't have access to within our own planet, which is underwater. And so I hope you enjoy the episode. I certainly enjoyed talking to him, and I hope you've enjoyed the last 5 years of episodes. I think we've had, I forget how many episodes, but over 100 for sure. Peter, any other words, any last words you want to add?
It's a great episode. Because it's such an interesting dive, and the famous last words are "was nice," and "let's meet in the metaverse as consciousness."
That's right.
Which will dissolve into the biggest AI that has ever emerged, and this is why XR is the future. And more buzzwords, no. Rock and roll.
Perfect. That's a very Peter ending. Yeah. I like it. Hello everyone, and welcome back to the Research VR podcast, the podcast behind the science and design of virtual reality. I am your host, Azad Balabanian, and with me today is special guest, Casey Sapp, the CEO of Virtual. Hi, Casey.
Hey, good to be here.
Casey, how did you end up in this world of virtual reality, and perhaps more 360 and diving for you, scuba diving?
Right. So I live in San Diego, California. I've been working on underwater multi-camera arrays for about 5 years. My now partner has been doing it for almost 15 years. He actually built the first underwater 360 camera back in 2006 on a Google Red Bull project using the Google Street View camera and going through a barrel. And then we ended up partnering a few years ago. But I think the quick backstory is that I grew up around the ocean. I played water polo. I was a diver from early on. I've been in the water my whole life, but I never saw that being a career, and I was never told that was possible. Did the finance and accounting thing, finally threw up my hands, said, I really want to, you know, pursue my passion, which was, first, it was moving to China and working in startups and small businesses. The Asian market was really interesting to me back in 2007, 2010. It still is, just harder to live there. And technology and education technology in particular transformed into virtual reality in 2015 when the Chris Milk Versus app released and people started to really see the potential for immersive storytelling and immersive learning. I quickly became, I quickly learned how to build underwater or 360 camera arrays. And as I started to do productions, I realized that there was an opportunity to be in the water, and I got hooked, and I gave up pretty much any other work that wasn't related to the water and the ocean. And I said, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. I want to be in the water. I want to work in the ocean. I want to make that a profession. And this is my opportunity that I can now do something I'm really passionate about and make money. And so now we, a generic company name.
That spelled a little differently, though.
It's spelled a little different. It's an acronym for Virtual Reality Technology Underwater Limited. So all we do is we focus on the ocean, and that is now 360 cameras. It is light field, volumetric, There is some sensor fusion. We have a couple military contracts around ROVs. It is deep sea exploration, and pretty much anywhere where more than three cameras or multiple sensors touch the ocean, we're kind of at the center of that. And our bread and butter is really Hollywood camera arrays. So working on what's now becoming pretty popular are high resolution LED displays, not necessarily virtual production, but the theme parks, the football stadiums, things that are greater than what one camera is able to record. And the bonus for us right now, to me, is the military stuff and the industrial stuff, but we're quickly starting to just be able to do the Hollywood stuff and have that pretty much off the shelf. We have the cameras, we have the systems, we have the arrays, and we're spending a lot of research and development money on industrial use cases now. Hmm.
I mean, when you guys first started this, what was it like? I mean, were other people trying to do 360 cameras underwater, or like, was this something that kind of had to be, it was like so special that it needed to be you that started to work on this? Like,
there was a group called the Ocean Agency, which put a bunch of DSLRs together and created underwater Google Street View back in 2012. And then there was that Google Red Bull project. And then about 2015, the GoPro Abyss came out, which my partner designed. And that was the first real kind of prosumer level camera system for underwater recording. It had sync issues. It, you know, had all kinds of different problems, but it worked. And so if you go out and do a Google search for underwater 360, a large proportion is going to be from GoPros and from that system. I started to really get excited about underwater 360 3D. No one had ever done that, about underwater live streaming. So then I went on this journey of building custom arrays. Whereas the market still, even to this day, you know, for the most part, uses what's either considered a GoPro Abyss or a Boxfish, which is a Zcam E1. And then you'll see the GoPro Max and Insta360 cameras, and a lot of people doing it on vacations and for fun. I'm really at this point the only full-time underwater 360 professional in the market. That's all I make money on. And there's other people who make money on a production here and there, but it's my specialty, and I have enough large productions that I only need a few to be able to really, you know, meet my numbers and live a comfortable life.
Yeah, that's super cool. I mean, I think from when I was first being introduced into 360, the shots and the things that really interested me the most were the ones that are so not conventional. So like, especially if it's a drone 360 shot or an underwater 360 shot or a CG even in space or something, like I always found those a lot more interesting than a stationary camera in a, you know, in a room or something. And so I think that's what really drew my interest into like taking a look. And I think it's, yeah, the fact that you do, seems like most of your, at least the videos that I watched were stereo 360 videos, but in fact, I noticed a couple of like interesting things, which was, I don't know if this is for all your videos, but maybe the recent ones where it's technically it's stereo 180 in front, but it's not like with most 180 videos, it's black behind you. You actually have a monoscopic view of the view behind the technically what's in front, right? Like where you are with the driving the camera rig. And so maybe are you like also pushing more pixels for the front view, like for the front stereo 360?
Man, there are so many different methodologies and arrays. Sure. There are so many different factors that go into how it ends up getting finished. Hmm. And it could be that people didn't want to do stereo on the diver because it was too hard.
Sure.
Or, you know, the array was just a 180 3D array and there's nothing in the back. There's a number of different budget limitations and time factors to these productions that there's a lot that's thrown away. And so the goal is to really just make it in a perfect world, everything would be pixel perfect. But what often has to happen is a judiciousness to where is the person going to look. But I agree with you. I think Jeremy Bailenson said it best in his paper maybe a decade ago about how that 360 is best when it's, I think it was like dangerous environments, rare, expensive. There was one other one. And underwater is really the only one that like checks all of the boxes. And it's, and being so passionate about the oceans, I get to share this space that no one else really wants to be in, or they're too afraid of, or they're not dive certified. And so for me, it's a big part of my life that I actually get to bring someone into this space that people don't often get to see. There have been a lot of underwhelming 360 videos and a lot of money, I think, that's been wasted over time trying to make something look good in 360 that could have been done on a TV. But underwater, it just doesn't matter. It's always unique. It's always special. It's always different. And it's a different perspective than what anyone's ever been given on a TV. And the headset feels like goggles, which is kind of crazy.
Right.
You get the same experience. And we've sometimes dressed up these headsets like scuba masks. Mm-hmm. And it really feels like you're underwater. You see people holding their breath. You see people, you know, taking it off. And it's just, it's 360 wasn't made for every type of scene and environment, especially storytelling, but underwater, 100%.
That's cool. That's a really interesting insight. Like, you as a filmmaker, then how, and with clients approaching you with wanting to do something in VR, and I think that I'm sure this is relatable to a lot of people. Like, how do you, what sort of like rules of thumb do you use to figure out if what they're asking is something that should be done in VR, or perhaps would would benefit from 360 or not? Sometimes people are, I think, perhaps don't know what to ask for. And, you know, you over the years have gotten better in terms of like understanding that, maybe, or maybe this doesn't really exist with underwater. Like you're saying, it's everything in VR would be cool.
Yeah. I think underwater, there's always an argument for that. It's good to shoot 360 underwater. The question is, how are we going to finish it? What's the budget? What are you shooting? Things that are going to be close? Are you trying to go deep? What's the resolution? There's a lot of considerations that I'm more often just punting these small budget productions to consumer grade cameras. And it really is interesting and attractive to me to be involved when it's ambitious. And ambitious today means something that's in the deep sea, something that's high resolution, live streaming, or high quality 3D. To date, I'm really the only guy that shot underwater 360 3D. I've been very fortunate to have a lot of smart guys on my team who have helped me research and build these arrays. Everything that we do is bespoke. Everything that we do is experimental. It's prototype. There's nothing commercial off the shelf about what we do. But when it's going to be in a theme park, when this footage is going to get shown for the next 10 years, when it's going to be 10, 20, 30K resolution, like, I really believe my team is the best group out there for it.
I'd love to hear a little bit about the process of how, let's go back 5 years. I think that's when you started kind of developing these cameras. Like, what was your approach then, and what sort of things you learned along the way to getting to the rigs that you're building now?
I put every camera is a learning experience, and there's a discovery process and a journey, and prototyping and experimentation it's risky. Sometimes if you're not careful, you can put your reputation on the line. You can really disappoint a lot of people. And so there's been a few moments that I've thought, wow, this may be the last project I'm ever going to do. Hypothetically, I think conceptually we know this is going to work, but when we put it underwater, we have no idea what's going to happen. And so the journey was, we had the GoPro Abyss, and then we started pitching 360 3D. And
I'm gonna look up the GoPro. I've never heard of it actually. The GoPro Abyss. I gotta see what it looks
like. Yeah, SeaWorld took us on, and they said, we want to build a theme park attraction with you doing 360 3D. At that time, we didn't know how many cameras were needed. GoPros were really what we understood at the time. We didn't know if this was going to be what the market was. So we started 3D printing arrays with 30 GoPros at a time and shooting and having, I mean, think about it. You're getting paid hundreds of thousands of dollars and every single one of these GoPros has to go fire or the shot doesn't count. And it was just stupid. It was
totally terrifying. Stupid.
And then we had to process this footage and we would start handing it to post-production houses and they'd just be like, there's just not a chance we're going to touch this. And, you know, we'd give it to India. They'd say that they could do it. There would be 50 guys working on it for 2 weeks and they didn't make any progress. And so I had to train up a team of guys to do post-production, which I brought from Legend 3D, which was one of the originators of stereoscopic conversion. These guys are the Navy SEALs of 3D post-production and visual effects. So we built our own pipelines and it became very, very apparent if we're going to do this again, we are not going to use GoPros. Mm. So we started sketching out. At that time, the camera was Blackmagic. It was because when you're building these arrays underwater, they have to check boxes, right? And if they don't check a certain number of boxes, you just can't use them. So one, they have to be small. So for example, the Red Komodo or the Red or the Helium or the Ari, it doesn't matter if you have an infinite amount of money. There's just cameras that are too big. Two, they have to have perfect stable sync.
So
if you don't have,
before you, so why do they actually need to be that small? Is it because you actually have to care, like it's offsetting your weight as a diver? And so that needs to be minimal. Parallax
just needs to be stitchable.
Okay.
So the farther out the cameras are,
okay,
the harder it is to actually, you know, bring that together into a spherical video.
So the sensors of the cameras need to be as close to each other as possible so that, yeah, they're not sticking out in huge bodies basically.
Right? Exactly. Okay. Yeah. And the bigger it is, the more parallax, the harder it is to stitch. Hmm. Not impossible, but there is this sweet spot where if you go beyond that threshold, clients are like, no, it's just not affordable. I don't want to do it. So there have been large arrays that have been made. I mean, Radiant Images is like they've done a lot. If you've gone down that rabbit hole and seen what they've done with their multi-camera arrays, and a lot of them are very, very hard to stitch. Hmm. And they're almost impossible to use. They look really nice, but if you take them out in the wild, especially natural history, they're kind of worthless. Hmm. So we have to have something, especially in natural history, which is the very typical 360 video production format, like a BBC or a National Geographic, a Discovery. You have to have a camera that is modular. You can put it on a plane. You can put it together easily. You can get it on and off a boat easily. You don't need an A-frame. And when you press record, all of them are going to record. And when you set exposure, all of them are going to set exposure. And, you know, when you're starting to get into these uncompressed mats where things are a minute, you don't want to run off the cards, because that's right there. That could be the non-starter for anyone actually green lighting a production. Like there is so many considerations. It's a lot of people think that 360 video is, you know, you can pull these experts from 2D video or photography and they're going to figure it out. And it's just like a different language. It's a different medium. It's a different language. It's and the rules don't apply to how other folks like to film. And I'll often work with cinematographers who are at the top of Hollywood. I mean, they're the best at what they do. and they're not willing to compromise on working with something less than a mantra. And it's like, well, guess what? You're never going to be in this space because you need to make concessions in order to allow the pipeline to be to work and to and for the budgets to work. And people are willing to shoot ProRes to have a finished product than, you know, to work with a Helium and spend millions of dollars and not be sure. So it's a different perspective, and that's what I've had to learn, just things that I have to let go.
So it's a constant compromise between all these different factors, to have something that can work anywhere, everywhere, like, and with you underwater. So yeah, I guess to go back to what you were saying, like one big factor is the size of the camera. So the GoPros were a big contender in that sense. Second, you'd said was the sync, and so also like kind of like global shutter, so that every frame is being captured together.
Easily programmable. So if you're going to build a Raspberry Pi or a Jetson TX2 or something that's going to be able to control, or a Nook or something that's going to be able to control all of the cameras like a single camera, there are cameras out there with impossible SDKs, hard to program for, and it's just not worth it. Sony's the perfect example. Like you would that with the quality that Sony has, that they would really care about their SDKs, and they just don't. And you look at the documentation and you start talking with these guys and you realize like, oh yeah, the camera syncs, but it only syncs at half the resolution, half the frame rate, you know, in H.265, it doesn't actually shoot uncompressed. And you're like, you know, it doesn't take that much to actually, why would you do that? Right. So Blackmagic and Zcam are the heroes of multi-camera arrays because they checked the boxes. And I would like to say Red, their sync is really hard to deal with. They're somewhat hard to program for. And then Ari and Alexa, the camera resolutions are too low because you're throwing away so many pixels through the pipeline. For example, how the lens sits on the sensor, where the image converges, that, you know, if I'm going to shoot, for example, a 20K by 3K, this is an actual project, a 20K by 3K 360 video. So it's not a full spherical. It's more of just a panoramic video. I'm going to have to shoot like three or four times the pixels in order to meet that target resolution.
Just because of how overlap much is
lost, because of overlap, because maybe the 4x3 setting doesn't use all of the pixels on the sensor. Maybe it's a 200 degree lens, but underwater you only get optics, sharp optics at about 170 to 180 degrees. So you're already losing 25% of the lens.
The periphery is much, you're saying in underwater lenses or a lens underwater, you have a lot less sharpness in the periphery.
Right. Once you go beyond about 180 degrees, you can't get sharp. You can't get sharpness. The distortion increases quite a bit. And so that's why you see a lot of these, you know, great Antonia fisheye lenses that are shooting like 300 degrees or 250 degrees, and they're just worthless underwater. So you want to be able to find the perfect balance of a lens that gets as close to the 180 as possible. It's sharp and sits on the sensor and uses all those pixels. And you start to go down the list and you start to really kind of parse out what your options are. And there aren't many, there really aren't. And so we keep going back to the same cameras, the same lenses, because that's really all that's available.
What's your current like go-to setup then that you're always pretty much sure that you can use it on a production and you won't have much problems?
Zcam E2, iZUGAR lens, maybe like an Olympus lens that's maybe 12 millimeter, 8 millimeter. And there's any number of configurations which you can do with those cameras, sync them easily, program them easily, and and you know they're going to work. And you're getting ProRes, you're getting 60 frames per second. That's also a condition I forgot to mention, that most of the projections and LED screens and even headsets want 60 FPS.
Sure.
So for example, yes, the Red Komodo shoots 6K, but it shoots at a 50 FPS. So if you're going to go down to 60 FPS, you got to go to 4K, and then you're back to really what the Zcam does. And the parity is, it's the 60 FPS seems to be the great equalizer right now for a lot of cameras.
Yeah, I noticed that when I was watching one of the films from the Nat Geo series, and I did notice that, yeah, when there were people, it was even, this was a scene on land, and so you have a lot, I think you can see more details, and so like I was looking at the motion of arms of someone, and I was like, oh, this is 60 FPS, like, and I was thinking, like, this actually, you know, it's nice that the video is 60 FPS rather than 24. I think just because, like, with VR, you really do need, you can break away from that 24 kind of cinematic feel, and the higher the frame rate, the more right it feels. Whereas I never feel that with 16:9 or, like, you know, 2.13:1, whatever, just film. Like 24 is so ingrained in our brains that I think with VR and with maybe real-time graphics, let's say, like, yeah, suddenly, like, the sky's the limit for frame.
You're exactly right. Yeah, and a lot of cameras and sensors just can't process that. Right now, you're seeing that it's kind of standard in the industry to have a 4K 60 frames per second camera. You start going above that, and the sensors just can't take it. So you look at the Zcam F or S6 or F8 or the Komodo, the Canon EOS 8K, they're all like 30 frames per second. And so there is this ceiling right now where you can't really get resolution and frame rate. You have to make a determination which one's more important. And right now, frame rate is.
This seems silly to ask because it's underwater, and underwater is cold, but is heating and heat management, like, is that something you have to worry about?
Yeah, it is. It's a huge issue. I mean, sometimes the water can be a great heat sink if you're in the Arctic or the Pacific, and otherwise it's just the bane of your existence. and there's a lot of things that don't work underwater that people take for granted above water. So for example, volumetric reconstruction, lots of IR and infrared used, right? Doesn't work underwater. There are a number of things that people have, that the number of technologies that are mature above water that they just don't apply to what we're doing underwater. And so underwater optics, for example, the larger the dome, the more sharpness you get. But if you have a large dome, then the cameras are hitting each other, seeing each other. You're not able to construct a frame.
The dome being what's outside of the lens itself.
That's right. Yeah. So in order to get the optical properties to look sharp, the smaller the dome, the less sharpness. The bigger the dome, the more sharpness with fisheye. But that creates a trade-off again, because how many cameras are you going to be able to have 6-inch, 7-inch domes? We're getting a lot into custom underwater wet lens design because there aren't a lot of options there. And ironically, like Jacques Cousteau and Nikonos back in the 80s made this lens that is this perfect sharp edge to edge fisheye wet lens. So essentially it's built for underwater. It doesn't work above water. And no one has made something comparable. So it's been 40 years or 30 years or something, and that is still the best wet lens for underwater capture. And all the best guys go out to eBay and grab them up. So the market is small, it's niche. You know, companies aren't really willing to invest in really high quality lensing. So we're having to make that up as we go.
That's fascinating. I mean, it must be that there's just not enough demand for something like that.
That's right.
Since then, and maybe there will be more now. And you know, some lens manufacturers would take it on because it sounds like a very interesting specialty sort of lens.
It's so niche, and it seems like everyone underwater, even when you look at the ocean engineering companies with ROVs, like there's nothing that's really truly commercial off the shelf in this space. Everything has its own uniqueness, its own differences, you know, and everyone wants something a little bit different. So it's really, really hard to mass produce something for the ocean. And so that makes it just ultimately more expensive.
I've every once in a while I look into like an underwater drone just to see if there's anything similar to like a Mavic that I can buy for underwater, let's say like photogrammetry. And yeah, it doesn't seem like, or there's quite a few options, but there's no like one clear answer for that. But do you think that's something that's growing? Like some, that
it is, you know, but the problem is Wi-Fi doesn't work underwater, right? And trying to get data to the surface through Ethernet is really painful because you're only getting like 5 megabits per second or something sometimes. Because as you stretch it out, you are just losing the signal, and there's other sensors on the ROV. There is, I don't know if you're familiar with the hot topic of deep sea mining right now.
Do tell. I mean, not enough that I have an opinion about anything.
So right now, all of the really critical components for the iPhone and precious metals in computers and technology comes from really war-torn areas like the Congo, right? And so these companies would definitely prefer to not have to deal with these third world, you know, kind of failing governments. And the deep sea has no limits, has no laws. There's no territory disputes. And the bottom of the ocean is filled with precious natural resources, 100 times more than what's in any of the mines in any of these, you know, African or Chinese countries. And a lot of people are investing quite aggressively right now in deep sea mining and paying the money to get the permits in order to do this. And there's a lot of people that are really worried about how much it's going to destroy these environments, how little we know. But what we're seeing is a pretty rapid technological advancement right now to get to the bottom of the ocean quickly, efficiently, cost effectively. And I like to partner with the deep sea exploration companies that are doing science work, Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, Ocean X, groups like that. And I'm passionate about that, but we're seeing a lot of companies come up right now that are making some pretty big advancements to get to the precious metals. So something to keep your eye on, because the supply chains of these big companies really depend on it.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I had no idea.
Yeah, sorry. I can be passionate about some of the most like esoteric stuff. And I think that's kind of what makes me, I feel like some fall out of the box sometimes of the virtual reality community, is like no one's talking in VR about deep sea mining. No one cares about illegal fishing. And that's when you're in the water and you're in the ocean, those are the things that matter. Those are the things that are important. And so I feel a little bit like a pariah sometimes in the VR community because I'm building something that's completely different. My needs are different. My applications are different. You know, I there are some good takeaways from many of the folks on your podcasts and, you know, on Twitter. And, you know, I do try to keep a community, but oftentimes we're just forging ahead on our own, doing our own thing.
Yeah. I mean, I completely agree. Like, in my opinion, I don't really care if VR or AR like reaches the numbers that they want it to in terms of like phones, you know, that's sort of like, oh, it's in the billions of units. It's like, to me, if professionals are using a tool for, or people, not even professionals, people are using a tool for a specific purpose and it's like giving them value and benefit, then to me, it's like a success in terms of what it could have done, and people have come up with their own things, use cases that they want to use it for. So like, I don't think there's anything wrong with what you're doing if you want to work within VR, but not need to, or just kind of have your, be in your own world within VR and not particularly engage.
Yeah. And it's funny, like, this isn't bitterness or resentment. This is just, it's a curiosity, but I've been involved for 5 years and, you know, sometimes there'll be these conferences that maybe are a little bit more selective that you have to apply for. And I never get accepted.
Yeah.
Because no one has any idea. No one, you know, is really thinking about underwater VR, AR applications. They're thinking about cool headsets or, you know, hand tracking or, you know, better lensing or, you know, some type of, you know, foveated rendering or something like that. But for us, it's just, how do we get human natural vision underwater? And that's a really big, hard problem to solve. And once you do that, it opens up all types of unique opportunities in robotics and unmanned systems and all kinds of other telepresence stuff. But that's really the one problem that we just think about all the time is, what does human underwater vision look like? And it's not necessarily an AR or VR problem. It's just a vision problem.
Yeah. In terms of exposing for underwater, like I don't really know how that works. Is it just actually just a really low amount of light and you're having to like for capturing very fast shutter speeds, or like how do you expose underwater? Use artificial lighting sometimes?
Well, you lose light spectrums the deeper you go.
So the colors change.
So you lose red and then, you know, green and then all kinds of other stuff. And where it just becomes black, right? And it, you'll often see when someone is shooting compressed or when someone's shooting without light, everything just looks blue. And so the goal is, how do I make skin tones look normal? How do I make the white look white? And that first needs to happen through shooting uncompressed. That's really important. If you're shooting raw, you can be a little bit more lazy and flexible because you just have everything. When you're shooting ProRes, you really got to nail the white balance. And then you need to make the determination of whether you're going to bring natural light down or you're going to do some type of like red or magenta or orange filters on the lenses. And when you're shooting at like 30 feet or less, you can bring all that back pretty easily. When you're shooting at 30 feet or more, you're fighting that bluish look. And that is the difficulty in shooting underwater. So your question about exposure is, as you go down further, you know, things tend to be 1,000, you know, 2,000 ISO. The shutter tends to just stay double the frame rate. People really work with f-stop a lot, which in multi-camera arrays, you can imagine how hard that is to synchronize, which we've done with our Z cams. So we program the f-stop in all the cameras to look identically the same. And so the goal is really kind of set the ISO at the natural limit of the camera, whether, you know, whatever that is, 500 or 1250, and really work with f-stop. And when you have zero visibility, you can have a very low f-stop and be wide open and it looks great and you don't have to worry about sharpness. But so the question about exposure. Yeah, I mean, I think that when you're at the surface, it's very harsh light. Sometimes you get refractions and flares in the domes. Sure. And there's all types of considerations that you have to do in these really harsh conditions.
The flaring
above water and below and really deep. And so there's this like, there's a very, very fine line between trying to find that kind of perfect limit where you're not fighting loss of color or flaring.
Yeah. The flaring is like, that happens sometimes with like drones. I remember the Mavic 1 had like a camera cover that you could fly with and the flare issues that come up with that. But you mentioned something about visibility and that kind of being a factor in terms of how you focus, perhaps, or what your aperture is set to. So then you're kind of having to consider, you have to have everything in focus in a stereo, especially in a stereo 360 video. Is that how it works? Because it's That's also something I wanted to ask you. Like, how do you determine, do you have a choice between focusing for foreground or background elements?
Not really. You're trying to shoot for infinity, really. And you want everything to be sharp in a lot. And that's just the easiest thing to do.
But how do you even do that when your aperture is so wide open? Like, that's the hard part, right? Like, you're not.
Yeah. Mm. That's why I have engineers, and that's where marine engineers become really, really valuable is helping solve these issues. And that's probably a topic that I could look really stupid on really fast, but it's, you have issues with chlorophyll in the water shooting, for example, in the Pacific in the summer, everything's green and disgusting. And there's these windows, you know, and then backscatter is this huge issue where there's like maybe life forms or, you know, little algaes or whatever it is in the water that the camera will sometimes focus on more than the object itself. And that's also a problem with machine vision and trying to get rid of that. You'll often hear photographers they're fighting that the most with their strobes and lighting, because that's just what gets picked up. So we're definitely working in harsh environments that are pretty much like space.
Yeah.
and so we have to have a lower set of expectations of what's possible.
Yeah, that's fascinating. There's clearly a lot more variables than one might imagine when it comes to filming underwater. I guess to move on from more technical stuff, like I'm curious to ask you about kind of what is the state of 360 both filmmaking today, like on the higher end of things, where you are, like you mentioned, Hollywood level, Nat Geo level. And then also what does it look like on the audience side, and you know, what sort of devices perhaps are they watching it on, or is it a lot of domes? What do you call them? Like just huge domes or large spheres? Like perhaps like also comparing it to 2015 and 2016 when VR was still coming around, when 360, I think was like, it was a big part of the pitch and the story of VR. How have you seen things?
It's fascinating. It's fascinating. The people were throwing money, you know, everywhere back in 2015 to 2017. And there was like this moment, I think maybe when Jaunt went under or Here Be Dragons, and it just stopped. And there was no more experimentation, and there was no more, you know, really unqualified people that were getting just major jobs. It's professionalized substantially over the last couple of years. And there's two really, it used to be, how do we just get 360 into a headset, or how do we get on YouTube? And you know, these consumer level kind of Insta360 cameras or GoPros, I've done a really good job of that. But what we're seeing now is Facebook, and in particular, is rushing to find the lowest common denominator for the mass market to create, you know, essentially cinematic storytelling, but with as few lenses as possible. So the less cameras you use, the less money it is, less investment, less processing, less syncing, and you can go back to that traditional post-production pipeline. So what I'm seeing is, at the really kind of cinematic storytelling level, is long form storytelling happening with 180 fisheye lenses. And that's happening underwater and above water. I think we'll hear more about that later this year. I'm also seeing a push towards greater, better codecs for 180 shooting. So people don't really value as much being able to look around, like immersion can happen in 160 degrees or 180 degrees. And so the question is now, how do we really get the most out of that? And I think that there's a lot of folks who feel like we've skipped a step, not really focusing on 180 enough. And so so that's happening, I think, at the consumer and maybe like kind of filmmaking side. And then there's the whole trend of LED technology outpacing by an order of magnitude camera technology. And so there's so many.
Can you explain that?
MSG Sphere. You can look it up. It's a 200 million pixel, 60 frames per second dome getting put up at the Venetian. And is there a camera that shoots 200 million pixels? No, there's not, right? And they are not the only ones that are doing this. There may be one of the more famous projects right now that's been pushed to like 2023. You can go and see the construction happening. But
it looks insane. It's like
yeah, I mean, there are a handful of projects that are being worked on around the world right now where 200 million pixels or 100 million pixels is just something not that one camera can't create. And it's a number of different types of screens and aspect ratios, but the prevailing theme is you need a lot of cameras.
Sure.
And there's not going to be a 16K 60 frames per second camera for another decade or two. So multi-camera arrays are becoming a lot more important, not for VR and AR, but for just traditional filmmaking. Large format 20 years ago was like McGalvery Freeman and IMAX, right? Mm. They're shooting maybe film, or they moved over to the Helium. The 8K is not large format anymore. 8K is standard, right? Yeah. A terabyte is like the new gigabyte, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, people shouldn't be so intimidated by a terabyte anymore. There, it's so prevalent everywhere, and so what I'm finding is there's a lot of projects that are coming online which need at least 5 or 10 or 20 high resolution cameras in order to meet the native spec or even up-res a little bit. Mm. So what we saw 2015 to 17 with shooting for the headset and trying to get people really excited about being in headsets, that's not really the goal anymore. Mm. Especially from a live action perspective. Secondarily, I think we're seeing a lot of an industry, for example, self-driving cars or security cameras that are starting to use a lot of multi-camera stuff just to see more. So I'm seeing a lot more companies working on multi-camera arrays, not for storytelling, but just for seeing, for observation or something like that. So Hollywood is is trying to simplify things, and Hollywood's also making things extremely complicated. And there's really nothing in between right now for kind of the average, maybe 360 professional.
Yeah, fair. No, that's an interesting answer. That I think also there's an interview which I hope will air at some point in the future that we've done that was like someone from the VFX, from a VFX company talking about how they do use multicam rigs now just to be able to overcapture a shot, right, and then pan and kind of pan through, that's the right shot and have it,
yeah, locked on. There's a lot of multicamera arrays. There's a few guys I follow on Instagram that it's just it's just camera porn. That's all that it is. And I follow all these guys, and you'll see a lot of these kind of really weirdly modular configured arrays just for a Marvel movie or for virtual production. Like you said, and that is also becoming important. It's not 360 per se, or even VR. It's just simply, traditional 2D filming and plating.
To what extent, I mean, I guess light field is not really a thing for people to do or to use. It's not, I mean, it exists, yes, but it's like not a approachable format of any sort, both from the capture and rendering like and experience side. But like what do you see kind of like the future in front of you, like in terms of underwater capture? Is photogrammetry or like volumetric something that you see like maybe becoming better and easier for you to use, or like I guess anything IR based, or it all has to be RGB, right? Or I don't know if LiDAR even works underwater.
No, I'm spending a lot of time on this actually. So in early September, Digital Life 3D is releasing a hammerhead shark model, which we shot in the wild with a multi-camera array. It's extremely useful underwater to have dynamic geometry meshes for biomechanics, for change over time, studying. I mean, there's so little we know underwater or that can be done in the wild. So photogrammetry is very mature underwater. Everyone does it.
Yeah.
They use side scan sonar. They use LIDAR. They use lasers. They use cameras. That is, you know, that's ubiquitous at this point. Volumetric video is a completely different problem underwater. You'll see one group, Mbari, who I brought up earlier, doing light field with a Raytrix camera, but they're still catching essentially a static object, but in a light field form. It's not really a video. So they're taking maybe like a slow moving animal and capturing just tons of data around it and then doing the 3D reconstruction. Mm. So you may have seen an article lately about the mucus filled like slug or something like that. And they had done a full 3D reconstruction. This woman named Kakani Khatija, who's an expert at this. Basic volumetric video is a huge opportunity of just being able to catch geometry or frame by frame video, which can be used for 3D reconstruction later. I'm working a lot on that, and it's a mixture of cameras and lasers and with budget, maybe even some sonar. Mm. Those are really the only sensors that you can use underwater to do kind of 30 frames per second reconstruction. And, you know, if you use laser, you don't get the texture. Use cameras, you don't necessarily get a really good mesh. So there's a lot of different games you have to play and tricks to being able to get both, and then, you know, maybe interleaving them and then being able to calibrate them later. So there's actually it's going to be a lot more animation heavy in the future, I think. But just being able to get good data is something which really no one's ever had. So, for example, the greatest shark researchers in the world have really only put a handful of sharks into a few small aquariums with 3 or 4 cameras to study their biomechanics. There hasn't been really studies on great white sharks or hammerheads or tigers in the wild. Those don't live really in aquariums. They die quickly. And so just being able to get more data and more information of these animals that you can't bring into captivity is a really huge opportunity. And so that's really what I'm working on, but it's not IR, not Wi-Fi. and trying to set up a volumetric studio underwater is not really that feasible either. So there's a mixture of April tags, if you know how April tags work, and which are like glorified QR codes and calibrated and synchronized lasers and cameras, and then doing essentially the blend shapes and doing the calibration of all of that data in a known 3D space later. So it's going to be a number of years to really make anything of this, but we're definitely making some headway.
Yeah. So it's just kind of a CG heavy blend of things, but not even a particular clear direction as to what's going to work the best or what the approach is going to work the best. But thankfully, I think there's also a lot happening on the computer vision side, on just kind of being able to, from single perspectives, like the whole volumetric reconstruction or like estimation research that happens from people or and like depth estimations, perhaps like there's, instead of adding more sensors, like I'm sure like good data is obviously very important, but like it might not need to be as much sensors as we might think, maybe in like a decade or two.
If I could just make one point that has become really illuminating to me is that, you know, when you see a lot of the 3D reconstruction of people through like an iPhone, it's because there's already a base mesh in what's considered a neutral pose of that person, right? Over time, we've developed a 3D model of a person. You just throw the face and the eyes because you know where those things are. That doesn't exist underwater. There aren't base meshes and neutral poses of fish and sharks. Hmm. So just to be able to get to that is a really big step right now for science and ocean exploration and all types of other research. And even Hollywood, I think if you're familiar, Avatar 2 is shooting pretty much everything underwater.
Hmm. Wow, I didn't know that.
They're doing it with a mixture of motion capture technology and a big contained pool in New Zealand, but the real opportunity is doing it out in the ocean, you know, because the ocean is just, it's free and it's wild and it's hard to control.
Awesome. Casey, it's been a really fascinating conversation with you about filming underwater for VR and domes. I want to just say one thing, that I love this one shot from the core of the Indonesian coral reefs video. It was a shot of a surfer coming towards you, and then a huge wave came in and like it clearly pushed you forward and her, and it kind of went over, and it really had that sense of what you feel when you're, you know, right underneath the wave and you move forward. So it was just like a very very surprising thing. I was like, oh, that was a very cool experience.
The one really interesting part of that shot was that we went to this remote island in Indonesia, and there are 2 days a year where these worms come out of the ground and they go into the ocean and they mate and people will get them, gather them for food. And we had no idea that we showed up that day. So when I hopped in the water, the ocean was just filled with worms, and I will never forget that shot. It's a beautiful shot, especially done in 3D. I wish there was more surfing stuff that was done, but I hope people get to see that.
Yes, I will have that linked down below. I believe it's. I'll find the name of it. But was there one specific, perhaps, series or film that you'd recommend people to watch now, after they've heard all of this?
One of the first ambitious film series I worked on was called Into the Now with Michael Muller. And we, for any number of reasons, we shot it in 2017, and it's supposed to release in the next couple of weeks.
Nice.
Wow. So I would say look for that. It may be on headsets. It may be on phones. I'm not quite sure, honestly. Hmm. I haven't heard anything for a while, but I have heard whispers that about 50 minutes of really blue chip, high quality 360 underwater footage is going to come out. And I hope people get to enjoy that and see that.
It's awesome. There is a 12-minute trailer on YouTube for Into the Now, correct? I think I watched that earlier.
There's a 2D trailer, and then there's a 12-minute film, which was shot at Tribeca.
Okay, awesome.
And that was the precursor to this series.
Very cool. Casey, it's been great having you here.
Yeah, thanks. Sorry, I didn't talk you off. And
not at all.
You too much.
This is our bread and butter.
So I appreciate the time, and it's good to talk with you.
Great. How can people reach you or find out more about the work that you do?
I'm on Instagram and Facebook and LinkedIn as Casey Sapp, CASEYSAPP, and happy to chat more if anyone wants to reach out.
Great. Thank you for being here.
Awesome. Thanks, Azan.